Hello.
Hello.
I'm Kendra.
And I'm August.
And you're listening to Book Dumb, the bookcast brought to you by a couple of dummies.
This week, we are so excited. You know that we love Hanya Yanagihara, and we are so excited to be reading her new book. We have just finished book one of To Paradise, which is Washington Square. This is the one that takes place in the late 1800s. We have not read the other two books, so this is just on those without anything from the next two books. I will say I have read like 50 pages of book two, but that's it. Kendra only has read book one, literally just finished it, and we are so ready to share. We're so ready to talk about this book.
Yeah, I literally finished it like an hour ago. So it's fresh in my mind and I'm ready to go. And I'm just really interested to hear like what other dialogue is out there about this book, because I've heard very little so far.
Yeah, I feel like I've been like purposely avoiding Bookstagram just because they don't want anything spoiled for this. I have seen like some reviews posted, but I also haven't seen a lot of content related to this, which is a little surprising because, you know, A Little Life is such a massive book in the Bookstagram and just book world that you think To Paradise would also be getting a lot of attention. But I mean, that's just me like having not been on Instagram that much lately and only have been on Instagram. So who knows?
Yeah, it could just also be my algorithm. You know, I also just haven't seen much. So I'm excited for, as time goes on, to hear more reviews. And so if you have read it or you're reading along with us, please, please let us know what you're thinking. Cause I don't know. I feel like we're going to be like shouting out into the ether and not knowing quite yet.
God, seriously. And also, just for context going ahead, we are going to do an individual episode for each of the three books for this novel. So right now we're covering book one. I believe next week we're going to be doing book two, and then book three is pretty long and also science fiction. So who knows how long it will take for us to get through that, but it will be coming soon. We also plan to do an entire episode just on the whole book once we've finished it. But also we'll see how we like the book. We don't want to, you know, make any promises. What if we end up really disliking this book? So I guess we'll see.
Or it's possible we exhaust the conversation with the three individual episodes. We'll just see. And then also you could let us know what you want. If you want, you know, one episode for the entire book as well. If you're like, nope, that's enough content on To Paradise, move on. That's okay too.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a good plan moving forward. But if you disagree with us, let us know. We're going to take that into consideration. Okay. But before we jump into this, what are you reading right now? I need to know.
Okay. I have been reading 7 Days in June by Tia Williams, which August graciously gifted to me, which she collected as an ARC. And I'm reading it alongside Dream Darwich. That's their Instagram name. So go follow them on Instagram. They're super, super nice. And they have a great feed, and it's Dream.Darwich.
Yeah, good friend of the pod.
Good friend.
I've done multiple buddy reads with them, and just stellar. We're about to be reading Conversation with Friends together next month. So
I love that for you both. Oh my gosh, amazing. We love book friends. And we are not liking it. It's so hard to articulate fully without giving spoilers, but I'm just like really disappointed in it. I saw so much hype around it. I thought it was such a cute story. The first few chapters are really compelling to me. And just as the books, we're about like 70% done, I think. As it goes on, it gets just more disappointing. And I actually think it's really like an unfair representation of mental illness at times and kind of dangerous. So if you've read it and you agree or disagree, feel free to reach out. I'm happy to talk more in depth about it.
Yeah, that was a book where I got it from a bookstore that I used to work for. They get advanced reader copies and they graciously give them to me because I guess no one else at that bookstore wants them, which ridiculous. And I picked it out on cover alone. I had seen it on Bookstagram and the cover is beautiful. And then I started flipping through it and I was like, I don't know if this is the right book for me right now. And so I was moving and I lent my copy to you, gave my copy to you, not lent, you can have it. Yeah, it just didn't seem like something that I wanted to pick up. And I'm sorry that you're not enjoying it, and then also Dream Darwich isn't.
Yeah, I don't regret reading it, to be honest. It's like kind of fun to roast. You know, when you're doing a buddy read, it's always just fun to talk about the book. And two, it was a book I probably would have always been curious about because it sounded really interesting. And I love reading books about writers, and like, this is about writers. And yeah, it just fell flat. And I think I'm disappointed because it just had so much potential, and the stories, or the potential of a really great story, is there, you know?
Okay, damn. That makes it even more disappointing in a way. So I'm sorry that you're having that experience.
Thank you. But, you know, enough about my boring book right now. What are you reading?
I'm actually in the middle of a bunch of books right now, which is unusual for me. Usually I try to keep it at two, and especially during the school year, I try to keep it to one audiobook and one physical book. But oh boy, I'm all over the place. So I'm listening to one you're going to love, Dear Centurion by Akwaeke Emezi.
No.
Love them. Yeah. So listening to that, I'm like 20% into it. Just beautiful, so like just devastating at times, but I love Akwaeke Emezi. The Death of Vivek Oji I read earlier this year and definitely lived up to the hype. Want to read more of their work so badly. And then also, I've been wanting to read this book for such a long time, and I just had a really hard time finding a physical copy that I liked. And I'm reading Zami, A New Spelling of My Name by Audre Lorde, who is a personal hero of mine. I have never read this. Sister Outsider is one of my favorite books. It's one of those books where I finished it for the first time and I immediately opened it back up again and reread it. And I'm reading Zami, and wow. I just love Audre Lorde. She's so talented. I don't know how she does it. Like, only like 30 pages in, and I'm like, this is the only book I want to be reading right now. So I think everything might take a back burner. I'm also reading some manga right now for one of my students who really loves manga and introduced me to a cool series called Chainsaw Man. And so I've been reading that with him.
You're such a sweet educator. That's so important to.
It's also just like, it's a pretty cool series. The art style is really cool. Definitely really violent at times. Definitely not my favorite at times, but it's been a while since I've read any manga, and I feel like this is a good series for getting back into it.
Amazing. I love to hear that.
Yeah. Okay. Are we ready for Washington Square?
Yes. We both have a brief disclaimer about life in this discussion. We're both I'll speak for myself, and August can speak for herself, but I'm experiencing a lot of brain fog lately. Just a lot going on with work, some major projects in the spring, a lot of publications to prep for. So reading has been harder for me. And so just as a disclaimer, I might not be as articulate as I want to be today. And if I miss anything in the discussion, I'm sorry, my brain isn't fully working and I'm doing my best.
And that is totally okay. You know, everyone has a lot of stuff going on. I'm similar. I just started school and was just moving, and also have been reading this book while at work. So I work at a library. I do have time to read while on the clock, which is very nice, and I've been taking full advantage of it. But also, like, patrons come up and you have to assist them. So I will read like a page at a time, sometimes not even a page, and then be busy for a while and then return back to it. So it's been kind of a stop and go reading process, but it's also pretty much the only time where I'll be able to like read a decent amount of anything. So that's the situation in which I've been reading and the environment that I'm in with everything else going on. The school year, you know, it's a lot. I've been doing a lot of work for that. So also some brain fog here as well.
Yeah. And maybe that will be more helpful. Maybe other people are also experiencing brain fog and they're like, oh my God, same, yeah. It's not alone.
Oh God. I think also, you know, we just had like our winter breaks with quotes around them, like, you know, having time off from work and then also from school. So I feel like I'm still a little bit in vacation mode, even though it was only for like a week and a half, 2 weeks for school. But yeah, I think that's a little bit playing into this a little bit as well.
And also, you know what I'm just realizing that we're not mentioning? We're in the middle of a massive surge in a pandemic.
Yeah, they're taking away the mask mandate. Yay, California.
I mean, I don't think
San Francisco has. I mean, the mayor hasn't said anything, but
I think in the spaces we work in, masks will probably still be happening. But it's scary regardless. And I don't know. It's a whole thing we could probably spend an entire hour talking about.
Yeah, let's step away from the pandemic talk. We can save that for our eventual Station 11 episode. But Yeah, there's just a lot going on. We're living in a pandemic. It's stressful. Everyone be safe out there. Get vaccinated. Get your booster if you can.
And tell someone you love them.
Yeah.
Spread some love.
Yeah, okay. Seriously. Okay.
Enough of this one, love stuff. Yeah, let's get to talking about the real stuff that matters. Books.
David.
Oh, David. God.
We'll get into what's up with David. I know that we both have a lot of thoughts, but can I just really quick share my experience reading this? Okay, so you just finished
I just want to do a real quick disclaimer that this is me full of spoilers. So it will be written in the show notes, but just in case you're listening, you're like, oh, cool, a nice spoiler-free review. This is not a safe space for you. This is a spoiler-filled place.
Spoiler-filled episode. Eventually, maybe we can do a spoiler-free portion for like the whole book, but that's down the line. That's in the future, and who knows what's in the future. But this book, I finished reading it like the first book of To Paradise, not the whole book. I finished it like a week and a half ago, so it's been a minute. Right after I finished it, I absolutely loved it. I was like, this is great. I love the 1800s. I love the late 1800s. Definitely like my favorite time period, I would say. So there was a little bit of bias there because I'm just like, oh, an alternative universe where it's okay to be gay in the late 1800s. I love that. And it's okay to be gay at any time period, just not, it was not socially okay, sadly. And still, wow, homophobia everywhere, gross. But I really loved it. And now that it's been some time, I'm kind of like, what even happened in book one? Maybe that's more like my brain fog again, but I don't know. I really, really liked it. I was like, this is like a solid start to this book. I am absolutely loving this foundation that's been laid. Still love the foundation, but now that it's been some time, I'm like, what went on outside of that letter from Charles that was so devastating and so horrible? It's the ICE letter. And then also David's shitty decision-making or questionable decision-making at times. So that's just what's sticking with me now, a week and a half later. So just putting that out there.
Yeah, a lot of that resonates with me. Having just finished it this morning, the last like 50 pages of the first book are very present in my mind. And there's certain elements of like the first, you know, 150, I don't know how many pages there were, 120.
I wrote it down 177.
Okay, amazing. So that means 127 pages are kind of all mixed together in my mind. But one thing I think that would be helpful for me and maybe whoever's listening is to organize the family tree of who we're talking about. Is that okay if I go ahead and then you can
go for it? Yeah.
Okay, because I'll probably need your help at one point, so do jump in. So you have the grandfather who is the patriarch, and they are the Bingham family. Bingham.
Yeah. Which also isn't that the last name of a character in Pride and Prejudice, Mr. Bingham?
Oh, you're...
Is it?
I think so. Yeah. No, Bingley.
I'm just going to double check this really quick because I'm pretty sure...
It's Bingley and Wickham.
Oh.
Oh, you know what? You're right. So Bingley is a nickname for Bingham.
Aha!
Atta girl. You did it.
I haven't read Pride and Prejudice in years. I've just seen the Keira Knightley movie so many times.
It's a good movie.
Sorry to sidetrack again from the family tree, but maybe it's a nice reference. I mean, this is not late 1800s is not the time of Jane Austen, but a tie to the marriage plot novel, which she helped popularize. So
yeah,
maybe.
No, I think there's a very like obvious attempt, not obvious in like in a bad way, but like clear attempt to replicate, like, as you said, the marriage plot novels, but all the like the 19th century novels. So that includes Austen, that includes Dickens, that like, I think, and also to subvert all of these tropes.
I agree. Okay, let's get into this family tree because I feel like we're just going to continue to get sidetracked.
Yeah.
And so also go ahead.
Oh, also just the family tree is confusing as fuck.
Yeah. So we have grandfather, which you started with, and he's in a relationship with Norris. But Norris is of a different socioeconomic class. And so they're not like official, but they are official.
Yeah, they're for sure partners, if not in name, but in like practice. And the Binghams are this like long-standing family. They're really important to the founding of the free states. And we'll in a moment go over what the free states are. But he, this grandfather, he adopted, is it the son? He adopted a child who was one of the parents of these three siblings, one of which is our main character. So we have John, who's this like everything, you know, a son is allegedly meant to be, where, you know, he's successful, he's following in the family business, he's well-liked, and he has a partner named, is it Peter?
We did not write down John's partner's name. I think it's Peter. I think you're right. But Eden, who is the other daughter, who I believe is a nurse. No, she's a nurse, doctor. She works in healthcare.
She's studying to be something. We sound like idiots now that we're working it through, but it's because
it's been a minute and it's also only briefly mentioned.
Well, also we're not idiots. It's just a lot going on in this novel where like these relationships aren't clearly defined.
Yeah. And also, so Eden is married to Eliza, who we love. But also this book opens up, and I had no idea going into this first book that they were living in a place where queer relationships were accepted for this time period. So it introduces Eden and then like talks about her wife, or it talks about John and then his husband. And I had to reread and I'm like, wait, really? This is what we're getting? This is great. Really, really cool. But it just kind of throws you into that. So if you're not aware of it going in, it's a little overwhelming. Not like the relationships itself, but how everyone relates to each other.
Yeah, it can get confusing, especially, like, I agree. I also didn't know that queer relationships were going to be safe and legal in this novel. And so those are the two older siblings. And then you have David, who's our main character. And David, by all accounts, is extremely different from his siblings. He's disconnected from the world, disinterested in the family business, which has something, which is like banking and trusts and just lots of money and stuff. And constantly throughout this first book, they're alluded to his illness, his condition. And you really have no idea what that is, but that he's ashamed of it and that the family has taken great pains to hide it. And he is also notably the only sibling who's not married. And now that he's approaching his 30s, it's expected that he should be married, and that arranged marriages are not only like common, but encouraged for like wealthy families, because it's a way to consolidate wealth. We see it to this day happening. There's just this, a lot of social pressure.
So his grandfather and siblings, I feel like they're not necessarily like trying to push the pressure of marriage onto David. I think, you know, his grandfather has this whole bit where he's like, I never said that any of my grandchildren had to get married. I wanted them to, you know, like the person that they were with. And I guess Eden and John were very lucky in finding their partners, and David having a bit more of a struggle. But just because his grandfather says that it's not necessarily something expected of him, he's still feeling that pressure. So I feel like there's a big weight on David's shoulders to like, there's this like whole idea of like growing up and like getting out of the house. So there's that.
Which I think is so interesting, because even in a world that completely changes history, and like you would assume that, oh, if like queer relationships and marriages are legal and totally okay in the free states, then this must be a progressive like country. This must be, you know, a utopia. But that's just clearly not the case. With, we see wealth inequality, we see racial inequality, we see lots of disparity. And there's still this patriarchal structure at work that, you know, expects, you know, a head of house. But even though it welcomes, you know, different genders to do that, it just is interesting to see these same power dynamics coming out.
Yeah. And it's also a society where like racism is still like very, very present. Like it is the end of the 1800s, and we see discussions around like treatment of people of color, specifically like Black people in this new world, in this new layout of the United States. We see like debates in the coffee house on whether, you know, people of color are actually people, which was a debate going on in actual history at this time. So that's going on there too. Also, I feel like the novel opens really well with discussion of the will, for talking about like income and the value of wealth in this novel. And it just reminded me so much of something like you would see out of like a Charles Dickens novel. Specifically, I think of like Bleak House, because there's so much with wills in that novel. I hate Bleak House. Hate that this made me think of that. But I definitely think she was pulling from Dickens there, as well as, you know, like Middlemarch also has a big, like a crucial moment of Middlemarch is the reading of a will. And it definitely took me there. And I was like, oh, where's Dorothea? Come on, let's bring her out. Come on, George Eliot, let's go through. Which you know, love thinking of that. But definitely, again, like what we were saying earlier, feel like Yanagihara is like trying to bring in these great novels of the past into this book.
That's so funny because you're so familiar with the Victorian Edwardian novels, and I have no experience with that. I immediately thought of Jane Austen, where I think three of her seven books open with a will reading. It's like the first scene, and it just made me think about how, you know, generational wealth obviously creates a lot of poverty for other people, as well as the uncertainty of inheriting certain things or not knowing what you're going to inherit creates for the individual and how it determines the rest of your life. And it's just really interesting to see those.
I'm just going to throw it out there again. Crucial elements of Middlemarch. Just want everyone to read that. Middlemarch is a perfect book. It's so big. It looks very intimidating. It was written in the 1800s, but fuck, is it good? I love it so much. Should we introduce some of the other characters? We had Francis the lawyer, who works for the grandfather. And then we also have characters like Charles and Edward. Do you want to tell me a little bit about either of these gentlemen?
I would absolutely love to tell you about both of them. The tea is scalding, my friends. So Charles is a sweet gem of a man. That's all you really need to know. Well, not all you need to know, but that's what you should really know.
I would say that he's like the human equivalent of like a Labrador or a golden retriever. Just gives off his vibe. Maybe a Great Pyrenees, because he's a pretty big, strong man. So I'm going to say he's the human equivalent of a Great Pyrenees dog.
Oh my gosh, not me almost spitting out my coffee because that was just so perfect. Yes, definitely puppy vibes from Charles. And so Charles is someone who's been presented to David. Again, he's our main character, as an option for marriage. And he's a wealthy tradesman. He's built a name for himself and his family in Maine, which is actually a separate country. So it's like the free state of Maine, I think, or something, from the free states where our main characters live. And Charles is just like, he's a widower. The love of his life died earlier. He's older. He's in his, like, I think, mid to late 40s. And David's like kind of repulsed by him at first, even though he's this kind guy. But I think maybe he's just like older. He describes him as like having a red face and like just like he's very unkind to his physical description. And the contrast to that is Sir Edward.
Not Edward Cullen, we wish.
That would be so
imagine,
amazing.
Imagine the sparkles.
David, this is the skin of a killer.
Hang tight, spider monkey, as he's like jumping through the streets. Well, we know, actually, never mind. I was about to make a Jasper reference, but I won't because he's not worth it.
Do you want to talk about who Edward is?
Sure. So Edward is a piano instructor at the school in which David volunteers. So David works as a art teacher volunteering at a school set up by his grandfather and his grandfather's bank company. And Edward is a paid piano instructor for children at this school. The school is for children of like lower socioeconomic class, just bringing them some art and music, which is, I think, a good thing, you know, to support the arts. But also you could do more to support like the actual children. Okay. But Edward is a piano teacher here, and he comes from very little limited means, and he meets David and they develop a friendship that becomes a relationship. David is shown parts of the city and parts of just life that he had never experienced before as a very wealthy person, such as Edward's boarding house, and also going to like a coffee shop together, which I thought was really cute. That's where the debate about race was held. But Edward is, I'm going to say human garbage, because I don't believe a word that comes out of his fucking mouth, as we have later learned in this chapter or in this book one, to know is true, because wow, he's lying about everything and he's going to fuck up David's life, which David refuses to believe because David is in a fragile state and has a lot going on and also just wants to be loved so badly that he won't listen to facts. So
yeah, we're getting big. Like I'm getting, again, Jane Austen vibes, where this man, this charming, beautiful man who seems to like could drop from the sky to nowhere into your life is really preying on your wealth.
Wait, should we get into how we know that Edward is a big phony?
Yes.
Okay, so David's been spending a lot of time with Edward, and he's been keeping it on the hush hush because he doesn't want his family to know. Grandfather obviously finds out. He's a rich banker. He wants to know where his grandchild is all the time, especially because David is typically home. He spends a lot of time in Washington Square, and he's had some issues with relationships and trust in the past. So, you know, he's a bit more of a fragile guy. We got to keep an eye out for him. Nothing wrong with that. And so his grandfather hires somebody to do some research into where he's been going and who he's been spending time with, and comes back with a report on Edward. We have seen his grandfather do this before. He did this for Charles as well. Just to have background information, the investigator did not find out some things about Charles, which inclines David to not believe everything he says about Edward. So there is that. But Edward had lied about where he had come from. So he said that he had escaped the colonies for specific reasons with his family, and then was able to get to the Free States. And here he was living in essentially poverty. And the private investigator finds out that that's not entirely true. Do you want to share what he finds out?
Yeah. So Edward came from a family that, you know, had lost their wealth for various reasons, mostly because of the father's gambling problem. And so they had to flee the colonies to escape their debts, really. And so when they were there, they were kind of abandoned by their parents, and it was him and his sister, Belle. And so him and Belle are eventually adopted by a nice, wealthy family, and they provide.
Weren't his parents killed, like, in actuality?
Oh my God, you're right.
Yeah, because yeah, in his story, they were, you know, attacked as they were trying to flee, which does seem to be true in actuality. You know, I'm trying to flee to a safe space.
You're right. I'm mistaken. So his sister, Belle, and Edward, who when they're fleeing the colonies, which is very reminiscent of like the Underground Railroad, lots of things to unpack there later in the discussion, I think. And they're being chased because they're fleeing the colonies, and they describe that their parents were attacked or taken by some men on horses. Within the Free States, there's a bunch of different like organizations that take care of children who have been separated from their parents or lost from their parents, because they treat them as refugees, for better or worse sometimes. And then Belle and Edward are adopted by a wealthy family who genuinely care for them and want the best for them, that as we're told, and they're able to provide for them. At the same time, Edward grows up like stealing and being mischievous. And as a kid, like, my first thought was like, well, he's a kid. Kids do, you know, kids make mistakes. But it seems to be a habit he grows into as an adult too, and makes worse, where he's just obsessed with swindling people. He has no reason to steal. He has access to money. I think it's a power thing. It's a pride thing. I'm sure there's lots of trauma from his childhood that's manifesting in these behaviors. And so he has a habit of preying on wealthy young men. So before he meets David, he's essentially pulled the same kind of heist on a younger man, and he takes the bribe from that man's father to basically like, you need to leave. You're not good enough for my son. I will pay you to leave. And Edward's like, sounds great. I would have left for free, but he wants
he would not have left for free. Yeah. He wants that money. Yeah. Yeah. I can't imagine the kind of trauma that he endured, you know, escaping the colonies, but then also like being a young queer man growing up in the colonies where it's not okay. Like, that itself is like incredibly traumatic. So of course, acknowledging that pain and trauma of his life, but also that does not mean that you get to go and inflict pain and trauma onto other people. It does seem like that his adopted father was a very strict person. It seems like his mom was very caring and loving. Of course, we only get like a brief description of them. And it seems like his relationship with Belle was spot on, but also just seems like he wants to con everybody and have that power by any means necessary, really, which is just so gross. And David's told all of this from a report gathered by his grandfather and refuses to believe that he's being conned, because he had already lost a great love of his life when he was a younger man. I believe he was like 17 or 18. He fell in love with one of his classmates and they had a great relationship. And then pretty much out of nowhere, he stopped returning his letters, and he later saw him on the street arm in arm with someone else who later became that man's husband. So he had a breakdown over that incident and then hasn't really been able to form a romantic relationship since.
Yeah, and I'm wondering how much of that relationship was like really a relationship, because David is very naive, like, and he seems to move through the world with a bubble around him, probably because of his privilege and wealth. But I don't fully trust that he was actually in a relationship with this guy. I think it's possible that maybe they like hooked up, which is, I understand, like, if that's your first time and like David's very attached to him, that can be very traumatic for someone to abandon you in that way. But I really got the sense that it was never really a relationship, and then David freaked out and scared this guy away, and it was just really uncomfortable to hear that story.
Yeah, and like we'll be clear, like he had a full breakdown in the street in a public space where he like approached this man with his now partner, like when they were arm in arm, and just like was screaming at them, like creating a big spectacle. Like obviously, like he is not doing well. And then he was taken back to Washington Square. And yeah, I don't think that David is necessarily the most reliable narrator because of how naive he is and how trusting he is. It's like, dude, come on. This is why he needs to be with Charles, even though he doesn't want to be with Charles. Maybe he just shouldn't be with anybody. Just like be happy, find love for yourself. But yeah, definitely Edward is taking advantage of him, and that impacts David's life and the lives of everyone around him.
Yeah, and I just thought of a moment earlier on in the text that I think is like a really clear manifestation of Edward's trauma from the growing up in the colonies, where when he proposes to David that like he proposes marriage, but also proposes that they move to the West and start this business. And David's immediate reaction, which is fair, that he's like, we're not safe to be there. People like us, so queer people, can't live there. We can't be out. We will be murdered, and it's terrifying. And Edward really dismisses it, and I remember circling this at the time because I was like, this is fucking weird that he would say this. But he said, nothing will happen to us. We are not like those people, which is italicized. We do not flaunt who we are. So there's a lot of internalized homophobia there that I'm sure is from growing up being told to hide who you are in the colonies. And I think this is like clearly trauma he hasn't worked through and is like showing up in a very toxic way.
Yeah, definitely. And then also, like, we have to consider here, like, he said, we're not like one of those people. Like, David has only grown up in a space where it's okay for him to be himself. He does not know anything else. And to ask somebody to go into an environment where they're going to have to hide something that they've been able to freely express, you know, like they walk hand in hand down the street, they walk arm in arm down the street, like they wouldn't be able to do that. And that's not something David has ever had to experience before. He's in a very safe space where he can truly, you know, be his authentic self. And asking someone to go into an environment where they're going to have to hide that authentic self is just not fair or right, I feel. So I think that's like a very early sign, because this is found out before we even know about Edward's actual history. I think that's like a clear sign of like, oh, this guy isn't necessarily thinking of David's best interest or like the best possible outcome for them as a couple.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Edward never really looked good. One, because we don't trust our girl Hanya. We have been burned. We know that people.
So many times I'm just gonna say really quick, I was scared when Charles popped up. I'm like an older man, no trust.
No trust. And look, we got played. So what ends up happening is David has to choose between Charles and Edward. It's a clear choice for him. He's so easily manipulated. He's very idealistic in a way that's almost childish. Where Charles, offers security. Charles genuinely cares for him. He and David leads him on in a really cruel way for a long time.
Should we get into that at all? Because
Yeah,
we
go.
have to talk about Charles's letter. That was my favorite part of this book.
Yeah, we'll go off. I know you got
Okay.
this.
Charles and David had met a couple of times for arranged meetings where they had like dinner together. And while David was not physically attracted to him, he did really enjoy their conversations and how he felt while they were engaging with each other. And this is a time where Edward has gone on a trip and has not contacted him at all. Or so we think. It's a notebook situation. The letters have been hidden. It had been 10 years or however long it was in the notebook. I don't know. I haven't seen that in such a long time. Wow. What a moment.
I have a quick question because I was really confused about this in the book. Is that okay if
Okay.
I
Of
ask?
course, yeah.
So when David finds a stack of letters from his grandpa that Edward had been sending him. I thought Edward admitted that he hadn't been writing to him when he left.
You know what? You're right. He said that he could have sworn that he sent the address. But then when he didn't get a response, I don't think he said that he wrote anymore. So another lie that Edward has been caught in, quite possibly.
Or just my brain not, might could be my brain missing something. But I was,
I mean, really if we're wrong, send us a message, let us know, because we'll never find out.
They will.
Okay, so Charles, so they're having this relationship during a time where Edward is gone. They begin a sexual relationship. And then Edward comes back and, you know, David ghosts Charles. Charles then at a certain point, I can't remember when this was. I think it was after their second meeting and like he hadn't heard from him in a while. He had to go up to Maine. Oh my God, guys. Hanya's just wrecking us already. But he goes to Maine and there's this tragic story in this letter that he wrote. And Kendra was telling me after she read it, she like, you know, when you see a letter in your book, you're like, I'm going to flip through and see how long this is, just so you have an idea. I mean, we do it with chapter lengths too. That's fine. This is a long letter. It's like 10 pages long from my memory. Yeah, Kendra's flipping through.
I was going to look for it, but I told August, I don't like reading letters in books. Usually I really get annoyed when they show up. And so I at first like flipped to be like, how long do I have to sit through this? This is an exception for sure. This was an interesting letter, but I remember thinking, are you fucking kidding me, Hanya? This is like the entire chapter. Wait, I found it.
And thank God it was, because what a wild ride.
It's 11 pages.
11 pages. What page does it start on, so our listeners know?
69.
Hey, okay. So after being a child there over the response to 69, this letter is fucking nuts. So basically he went up to Maine and there was a horrible, horrible storm where it became really icy, really dark, basically out of nowhere. And he and one of his nephews, I believe, right? Yeah, one of his nephews have traveled up there. His nephew had never worked in the trade before. And so this was kind of his first trip, an introduction to what he would eventually be doing. And he, one of the nights that they were there, was evening, it was a nice day outside. He went out to go ice skating and weather turned incredibly quickly, snowstorm. One of the sons of the people that they were staying with went out to look for him. You can't see like anything, like it's a horrible, horrible winter storm. And Charles's nephew comes back because they sent dogs after and finds him and reveals that the other man had fallen through the ice and was trapped under. He had seen him be trapped under the ice, trying to get him out, and he eventually freezes to death. Charles's nephew also almost dies because he was exposed to such harsh conditions and was really saved by these dogs, who the dogs also went back out and tried to find their person, just showing how great dogs are. Love the dog representation in this book so far. If anything bad happens to a dog, Hanya, you didn't do it in A Little Life. If you do it here, I'm going to be mad. But Charles like recounts his experience and just like the detail that went into the story of these two people being lost out in this horrific storm and then finding one of them and then finding the other like frozen. Oh God, it's, I don't know why, but I loved it so much. It was so just like devastating, but also just so cool too. I feel like I haven't read a lot about people just being trapped out in storms like that. Like it gave me some like Revenant vibes, but yeah, I just really enjoyed that.
I got major Frankenstein vibes, which is also an epistolary, well, partly an epistolary novel, but yeah, I mean, it's just such a great trope to execute for this time period where letters were so important for communication and storytelling. And like, they were often very long. So it's not, you know I was annoyed that it was 11 pages, but really that was the norm. Yeah, that letter specifically was riveting. I think we both picked up on some tragic love story happening within that letter. And I just think it's really interesting that Hanya is like layering all of these stories. Like we've said, this is like an attempt to like replicate the 19th century novel, but also to make it her own and to modernize it, and also like to make the next great American novel whilst restructuring America. And she's just taking on so much, which is why it's massive. And I'm starting now to get anxious that it's going to be too much and the execution is going to fall short at some point.
that I feel like that fear is very valid, but also we're only 177 pages into this like 500, 600 page book. So we do have some time. I trust Hanya. I mean, how can I not after Her Little Life? I mean, the only other book that I've read by her, but because personally, I love an epistolary novel. So having them, like, it reminds me of like what you were saying, like with Frankenstein and then like Jane Austen and Dracula at times too, getting into these like crazy dynamic relationships. And I love this connection to this idea of her crafting this great new American novel while also completely restructuring the layout to the United States, which was very confusing for me at first until I looked and found that there was a map in the front cover. So
same, dude. Oh my God. Should we talk about what's happening here with the restructuring? Because
sure.
Just in case you read it and you're confused like us, or you're reading it because you're like, you're listening because you don't want to read it. So this is speculative fiction in that it reimagines what could have happened to the US after the Civil War or as a consequence of the Civil War. And it's so I'm looking at the map and I'm like, we're divided into 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 countries. Oh, because of Canada.
Well, I'm also including, it looks like Hawaii is an individual kingdom.
Beautiful, as it should be.
Which, as it should be, yeah.
And we know that Hanya Manokahara is from Hawaii, so I'm sure this is going to be a really personal exhibition at some point.
I will say from just a brief look into book two, Hawaii is very present. So
I'm excited for that take. And so after, so the Civil War essentially splits America. I mean, pre-Civil War, you know, it wasn't what it is now. It wasn't the 50 states. And so the colonies are really the South, you know, the states that chose to secede. And so that's Georgia, South Carolina, Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, Louisiana, Missouri, Alabama, Texas, Arkansas, and Florida. I'm really proud of myself for knowing all of those abbreviations. And the free states, that ends up being the North. So you know how it's the whole North versus the South thing. The free states are Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Vermont, Rhode Island, Delaware, and Connecticut. So the East Coast, really, except for Maine. So the North Republic of Maine, I don't know why. Do we know why they're their own republic?
Because the weather conditions are so harsh that they've just let them stay as like kind of like a Switzerland of this new United States. But that's just from my memory. I could be wrong about that. I just remember them talking about the shit weather.
I mean, that sounds incredibly right to me. And so in the middle, they have uncharted territory, really, which to me just means they haven't colonized it fully.
Yeah. Are we talking about the American Union?
Almost. So that's above the uncharted territory. So the uncharted territory must be Utah.
I didn't even realize that that was. Yeah, that's Utah, New Mexico, and Arizona.
Yeah. So this is.
And a little bit of that one that's over Texas.
Yeah, sorry, I don't know geography very well, but this is unceded territory today.
Okay. And then is that Louisiana? No.
Louisiana is
down next to it. Yeah. Okay. Just trying to think of what that would be. Well, we live in the United States. We should know this, but also we don't teach geography here. So
it's Utah and maybe Nebraska.
I know it's for sure Utah and Arizona and New Mexico. Oh. And then a little bit of something else. We could look at an actual map of the United States. I literally have a globe in the room that I'm in, but I'm not going to go to it because it's not worth it to me.
I genuinely don't care enough.
Okay. And then we also have outside of that uncharted territory, we have the Kingdom of Hawaii as an independent place, as it should be. And then we also have the Western Union, which is California, Washington, and Oregon. Best states. Love. And then we have the American Union, which is Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, Colorado, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, Minnesota. Did I already say Minnesota? Yeah, Minnesota. And then Iowa, Missouri, Wyoming. No.
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin, Illinois. What's MI? Michigan. And then Indiana. D.
Maryland. I
don't know my states. Maryland, Ohio, Kentucky, West Virginia, Nevada. Wow. No. And Nevada. Okay. And that's the American Union. Don't know our, I personally do not know the breakdowns of state names. So do know California, Washington, Oregon, though. That's all that matters to me. So that is the layout of this new United States.
And one of the reasons we felt like it was important to describe is because it's confusing as fuck when you're reading it, and also confusing when you're looking at a map. So I'm curious, August, like, what did you think about this restructuring of America?
Well, at first I didn't realize, as I said earlier, that there was a map in the front. So like the first 30 pages of the book, I was like, what's in the free states and what's not? I think that was like the hardest part for me, because I was like, okay, obviously New York isn't the free state, so I'm assuming other states around it. But I really like this restructuring of the United States. I feel like it's going to lead to interesting conversations, especially later in the book, since it's the same layout, I'm assuming, just years later. So next book, I believe, is in the 1980s, and then the third book is in the distant future. So I'm excited to see what happens with this layout over time, especially since we've already had these conversations of people being treated differently because of like sexual orientation, gender identity, race, and things like that. And I feel like that's going to continue to bring about interesting discussions. And I trust Hanya with those discussions, or I trust her at this time. Who knows what will happen? But yeah, it was really confusing at first, just like the layout of the family and everyone involved. I feel like, you know, you're thrown in to this deep pool of just information and just told to kind of figure it out as you go, which I really like in a novel. But also the first 30 pages were really overwhelming for me.
Totally agree. I think there's a lot of thoughtful and intentional world building, and it's really hard to wrap your mind around. When I'm glad that map is here. I'm always a big fan of maps. Yeah, I think it's interesting. I honestly wish they'd gone more into the history. Like, you know, I love reading about history in books, especially like fictionalized history. I think it's fascinating. I would really like to get into like what happened during the war. Like, what was different, or was it, or was the war essentially the same and it was really just the end result that was different? And we learn, because I can't remember if I said this, but like the Bingham's original ancestor, like great grandfather, is one of the founders of the Free States, which is why they're so wealthy. And he did it because he was in love with a man, and he, you know, the South had many, many things that he did not want to be a part of, slavery being principally one, and then homophobia being the next. And so he wanted to create a free country where people, regardless of sexual orientation and gender, notably does not include race, can live a safe and successful and happy life together.
I'm just gonna interrupt here, and I think this is very important because there is a lot of racism within the queer community to this day. There's also still a lot of transphobia. So I feel like this is Anya making a point of the fact that, you know, historically, the people who have made a lot of difference within the queer community have been trans women of color, historically overlooked. I highly recommend watching Paris is Burning, looking up Marsha P. Johnson. There's a great documentary about her and Sylvia Rivera, as well as there's a documentary about Compton's Cafeteria here in San Francisco, which happened, I believe, a year before Stonewall. All trans women of color, also sex workers as well, historically overlooked and also historically put down by white gay men in the movement, historically silenced by white gay men and white queer women of the community. So just something to keep in mind. And I think Anya has intention there with doing this, because it's still such an issue in the community today. And I think she's just like highlighting how this has been an issue within this community from the beginning of this world that she's created.
That, I totally agree. Resounding rubber stamp. It also read to me about how liberal spaces are not always safe spaces for many people. And there's a lot of performative like liberalism, and just the term like liberal leaves out a lot of, you know, progressiveness, and justice is not always achieved when we say it is, because there are large groups of people who are intentionally left out of that.
And also, like, I think it's important to know from my memory, and I could be wrong with remembering this, but the Free States were only able to become the Free States because of the incredibly wealthy people that lived there. So they kind of bought this in a way, having that purchasing power. So it's also an area where class and wealth are very, very present and just super visible. Also, like, just the fact that you have, you know, these children living essentially in poverty as orphans coming from these colonies and other spaces, and not really like going and doing the work to like actually help them. Of course, like some children are adopted, but if you're older, just as we see in the foster care system today, if you're older, you're less likely to be adopted. So just getting into that as well and the inequality there.
Yeah. And yeah, there's so much to say there. There's a really tricky situation happening with the refugee crisis in this book, where on the surface, everyone is like, we're the Free States. We welcome everybody. We are this happy utopia-like place. But in reality, they're also having conversations where it's like, well, we don't want too much of this community. We don't want them to overrun our country, which is, you know, xenophobia that, you know, we've seen throughout time. But I think it's just a really clever thing for Hanya to do here, to be like, there is no utopia here. Just because one group is safe doesn't mean another group is safe. It's fantastic to have what they do have in this country. Another thing to note is the nonprofit that the Binghams run. There's so much I could say. As someone who works for a nonprofit, the nonprofit industrial complex is a really problematic thing operating across the world, but specifically in how it operates in America. And I saw that really represented in this book, where the conversation is like, oh, we're so good. We're providing for these under-resourced kids. But at the same time, you know, we're really readying them for service level jobs. We're not teaching them, you know, to find their passions. We're not inspiring them to go on and do great things the way we would with our own personal wealthy children. They even say at one point, like, teaching them music and art is a waste of time because they won't be able to use it in their day-to-day jobs. So, you know, I'm thinking of Pedagogy of the Oppressed, where it's like, oh, we're raising them to be docile and obedient so that they can be, you know, service to us.
Yeah. And I feel like we completely see that. And we also see it with older characters who are in the service industry. Like, specifically, I think of Norris, who is the grandfather's partner. Seems like they've been longstanding partners for quite a bit of time. I can't remember exactly how long, but it seems like he's always been present in the three children's lives. And they're now in their 30s or late 20s. So a while. Grandfather won't even go and like make things official for him, even though they're able to in the area in which they live. But he just doesn't do it because there's that class barrier and that's frowned upon. And then, of course, you get into David's relationship with Edward. That large class barrier there is a major issue there at first. And then you get into everything else with Edward, but what else?
Which I think is so interesting, because if really this family is, you know, what essentially seems like royalty in the Free States, like everyone defers to them. It really doesn't seem like if the grandfather was like, fuck it, I'm in my 60s or 70s, I'm going to be with the man I love. I have enough money to determine how I'm treated at this point.
Yeah, set the precedent and make it okay. You're totally right. They are essentially royalty in this space. And like, it's also like everyone knows that they're in a relationship with one another. Like, why would a marriage impact that? And also, like, they have a whole thing where they talk about like his will and everything. And I'm assuming they can get like prenups and everything as well. Like, if you're worried about that at this point in time, which I don't think he needs to be worried about, do that. I don't know.
Gross. Yeah. It feels like, what's the point of having the freedom to marry whoever you want if you actually can't marry whoever you want?
Yeah. Is wealth more important to you and like public opinion of you than your own happiness and the happiness of your partner? Mm-hmm. Seems gross to me, but whatever. Should we get into the ending of this first book and how we don't really have an ending?
Yeah, it's hard for me to like say what I think of this book so far because it feels obviously so incomplete. So what did you think of the ending of the first book?
Okay, so just for jogging my memory, the first book ends with David agreeing to go away with Edward and like his trunks are ready and he's leaving. He says goodbye to grandfather. Grandfather's like, please don't, tries to make his final plea, but David ends up leaving. That's how that ends, right? But we don't know what happens to David in California. I think that he's going to get scammed by Edward and Belle and the other two people that they're going to see in California. So they're talking about opening a silk industry, right? Or starting a silk trade there, from what I remember. I could be wrong about that. But they're going to California and we just don't know what happens. We know that California is not a safe space for David to be himself. We know that David has pulled out all of his money in gold because gold is universal currency. And so obviously Edward has access to all of this gold, and you know, it's not like it's easy for David to get in contact with family members from the other side of the country or multiple countries with this restructuring of the United States. So we don't know what happens to David.
Yeah, we have no idea, but I'm just going to say it's not going to be good. I'm confident in that. I thought the ending was really interesting. I felt so bad for the grandfather. He was like crying, and you could tell it was so hard for him to cut David off when it, you know, Hanya could have written it to be like, no, I disagree with your decision. You're dead to me, kind of thing. But there's so much pure love that the grandfather has for his grandchildren, specifically David. He's really attached, and you could tell that he really sees David for who he is, which is naive. Like, he really doesn't understand how the rest of the world works, and the grandfather's like reasonably scared for him. One, because the West is unsafe for him, and two, because Edward is unsafe for him. And we see that like David has a history of falling apart, and I say that like with compassion. I don't know if there's a better way for me to phrase that, but he really doesn't have the emotional capacity right now to be let down by Edward.
Yeah. And like, even like, let's just say this is like actual American history. It's the late 1800s, you know, mid 1890s. Like, California is already a very dangerous place to be. We have like the gold rush, the restructuring of San Francisco. It's before the great earthquake and fire, but like, it's not the safest place to be just in actual history. And then like, you bring in the fact that the United States is divided in this way. David's going to have to keep the fact that he's a Bingham a secret. He's going to have to keep where he's from a secret. It's going to be bad. I don't see any good possible outcome. I don't see, like, obviously, like, people were in the closet at this time and were able to like hide and, you know, be somewhat happy in those lives, or try and find happiness in those lives in secret. But I just don't necessarily see that being a possibility for David. And I think I wouldn't be surprised if they like killed him and stole his money. When I was reading it, it immediately made me think of Corpse Bride and what happened to the Corpse Bride. I'm sure there's like a better literary reference. In fact, I know that there is, but
no,
that Tim was Burton, perfect. He's in my head. Yeah. So I thought it was going to be exactly like that, where, you know, this guy comes and he's so charming, but he just wants to steal the money. And so kills. And I wouldn't be that shocked if that happened here.
No, I totally agree with you. Like, it's not going to go well. And at the same time, I like kind of see exactly why David made this decision, being who he is. And he shared so many insecurities about like feeling out of place in his family. And despite like his love for New York and the house itself that he grew up in, he doesn't have much of a life there. And that's partly because of like what I'm going to classify as a mental illness. Just from my experience, that really resonates for me. He's someone who seems depressed or, you know, with something going on, and he wants something to make his own. And I just felt like the last page of the first book was so beautifully written, and that he was remembering this memory where he was talking to his grandfather and about heaven and like what heaven could be. Grandfather had explained that like everyone has a unique heaven, so my heaven is going to be different than yours because you're a different person than me. And I thought that was just like a really beautiful message for a child. And so he was thinking about he would want out of heaven, and now as an adult reflecting back, he has the hope that this will be his heaven and that this will be the place like where he belongs and he feels loved and secure. And it ends with to paradise, which I think is just beautiful. And of course, you know, I'm thinking of Paradise Lost. I feel like you were all,
of course you are.
Yep.
We've been waiting for it.
I know. And I'm so sorry. And I'm not at all sorry at the same time. But Paradise Lost ends with a similar message that happier within thee is the best happiness. And so to find a paradise within yourself is the ultimate goal. That's like Milton's message, is that the gift from, you know, his God wasn't just like creation, but also the opportunity to go and find your own happiness outside of the world, like the Eden that God had imprisoned you in some way. And so that message really rang true to me, where, you know, at the end of Paradise Lost, Adam and Eve, they're at their lowest. They've had an awful fight, but they leave hand in hand together to search for their own individual, not together, their own individual paradise. And I just really hope David finds his paradise. I hope it's not actual like dead heaven, you know, but he deserves it.
Yeah, he really deserves some joy. And I feel like, you know, you're totally right. Like David, he had this Eden established for him, but it wasn't necessarily like what he wanted out of life. And he has a lot of pressure of that family name and also just his family around him. So of course, like going to a new place where nobody knows that name is so enticing. You're able to start fresh. You're able to like be your true authentic self without that pre-existing knowledge of other people, like knowing your family working against you. So I feel like there is something very freeing about him going off on this journey, but also it's so dangerous. And I just like wonder if maybe there would be another way that David could have had like a similar experience of like erasing his family name, but like still living in a space where he can be safe. I don't know. It's just hard.
I guess we're just going to have to keep reading to find out.
Yeah. I'm wondering also how these books tie together. I've read a little bit of book two, but I'm going to keep that to myself because you have not, and I want you to have a fresh experience with it. But I'm excited to see how they tie together and if maybe we get a little bit more of this David story.
I feel confident making a prediction, not because I think I'm right, but because I know nothing about the second book, so I know I won't spoil anything. I feel like David is going to go through some shit and he's going to survive. And I think either in the second or third book, maybe both, we'll be reading his descendants' story. And so there might be reference, because there's so much of an emphasis on ancestry. And like August mentioned this, the names, is that nomenclature?
Yeah.
So August mentioned that, and that was like a great pickup that I totally miss, is that names are so important. So I just feel super like super confident that the David name is going to come back.
Yeah, I'm sure we're going to have some stuff to deal with, like legacy of the Binghams. I'm just going to keep my lips sipped for this, but yeah, I'm just, having read what I have read of book two, I'm just like, I need more. And obviously I'm still like very early in book two, so I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm excited to see how this legacy lives on and how it continues.
Me too. I'm like really, I know that the next book is present day, right?
1980s.
Oh, so somewhat present
yeah.
day.
Yeah.
Oh no, is it?
Yep, you already know. She's already handling it better than fucking Great Believers. So yes, this next book does deal with the AIDS crisis. And from what I've read so far, it's handled fairly well. I mean, again, I trust Hanya based off of just her representation and tackling of hard issues in A Little Life. But I also know A Little Life is not for everybody. But from what I've read so far, she's handling it with the grace that we know of her.
Okay, that's super great. Because yeah, we've been burned by that by other authors. Okay, and then the third one I know is in the future for sure, because the people I have heard who have read it talk about how they don't like that one. So
I've heard different things. Some people say book three is their favorite. Some people say they hated it. So
exciting.
I guess we'll have to make our own opinions. But I guess those are our thoughts on book one. Let us know if you had any similar thoughts or if we left out anything that you thought was so important.
Totally agree. Please reach out if about book one. I have not read any of book two, so don't give me spoilers about anything else at this time. But yeah, this is a part of a series. So we're going to cover book two next and then the book three following. And depending on how those discussion goes, what feedback you all give, we're planning to do at least a mini episode on the whole book in case you don't want to listen to like 3 different ones. But yeah, you know, you can always reach out to us with any questions, any recommendations, buddy read requests. So you can find us together at Book Dumb Podcast on Instagram. You can also email us at bookdumbpodcast@gmail.com. That one I struggle with. I always forget that. And then you also can reach out to us individually, which I'm Kendra. So I'm Kendra Lapp at Instagram.
And you can find me, August, on Instagram at Iggy Poop. You can also find our episodes are available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, where you can also now leave written and star reviews for both of them. So feel free to leave us a review. Let us know how you're feeling, but also feel free to reach out to us on Instagram.
Yes. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you always for your support. We love and appreciate you.
Yeah, and we hope that you're having a great day.
Bye.
Bye.